good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this tax day. It's April 15th. Aren't we lucky? but everyone's fine. I'm sure you're doing well in the tax department. We're not even gonna worry about that part of today, and just look at it as I don't know. It's a Monday. It's a.
It is what it is.
It is what it is. That's right. We had a wonderful, hopefully you had a wonderful weekend. We had a, Bruce Springsteen's in town tonight, so that's a good thing. That'll be better. That's better than tax day. What else? Anybody got anything?
Well.
Anything I'm forgetting?
Well, in another Heidi football moment, remember when there was a big football game on, this is when I was a kid, and it was like a playoff or something, and they cut away to Heidi, the show.
Yes.
Right? And the game was won in the last 2 minutes, and nobody watched it. Last night, the Billy Joel concert, the 100th concert at Madison Square Garden, you know, I taped it. We were watching it for a while. I got up this morning to Facebook exploding because they cut to the news. It all was late because of the Masters. They cut to the news in the middle of Billy Joel singing Piano Man. And it's like, you can't get any stupider than that.
No, I think the more apt, and I'm not
well, you know,
disagreeing with you.
I grew up next door to his town.
No, I'm just saying the more apt comparison, I think, because it was Channel 6. Although I know WRGB is saying that this was a network thing, and probably rightfully so, because the whole network screwed it up. However, I don't know, for those of you who remember the finale of the Newhart show.
Oh, right.
They put the wrong time codes in. And the whole end of that show is where it was all a dream. That whole thing got knocked out.
Like Dallas.
And it just, it was like they made this reveal, and then they immediately went to Ernie Tatro. And I thought people were going to tear down the station. Yeah. So, yeah, well, it's a lot. I have a couple of things I would like to announce here before we get started and we welcome our group. First of all, sad news to report. Nick Barr, a familiar voice to this radio station, he was a wonderful musician. He played fiddle, guitar, banjo, bass, mandolin, and hosted a bluegrass radio show on WAMC for years and years and years. And up until I think just two or three years ago when he took ill, and he passed away at the age of 75, and last week, and we send our condolences to his family. We missed him when he stopped coming in all the time. He was a lovely, lovely man, so versatile, so talented, and just as sweet as you could think of. You know, these hosts and Wanda and Tim Coakley, these wonderful people who come in, we don't see them a lot because they come in the middle of the night on the weekends and do these shows. But every once in a while, they were always there at fun drives, and they were always there when we had events. And it was just so nice. And Nick was a lovely, lovely man. I remember working with him. We did a moth event at the Egg. And he played the interstitial music on stage, and they sort of play you off on the moth if you're going too long by having a fiddle go. And Nick was the fiddle, and my God, he enjoyed that. That was sort of like his gong show moment. It was very, very cool. So I just wanted to mention that there's an obituary on legacy.com. There's also an obituary in the Times Union, and true to his the beauty of him, he's asking for any memorial contributions to be made to WAMC, which is a gorgeous way of remembering him as well. So I just wanted to make that note if you had not heard previously that Nick Barr passed away, and we will miss him very, very much. It seemed like there was something else I wanted to. Oh, yes. I want to also mention that this Friday we are going to be having a special panel at the Linda, a live panel at the Linda. And we have a really great lineup of panelists, and there are tickets still available. I believe they are $75 each. All that money goes, of course, to WAMC. And we always have fun at these events. They're a lot of fun. You get breakfast, you get to meet with your fellow WAMCers. I think you usually have fun. People usually have fun. If not, then I haven't heard about it. But maybe they wouldn't tell me. I don't know. But we're very excited to have another group, and we have a wonderful panel. And if Facebook let me in, I would tell you exactly who it is. But I'm having problems with that right now. Yeah, well, it is. It is a lot of the women. Let's see. Do you remember offhand? I know you're a part of it.
I am.
Judy Patrick is a part of it.
Right.
I'm looking to see. Nick Rangel. I don't think Heather.
Judith
Ink. Right. I'll get the list.
Sienna.
Yep. Sienna Freeman Colbert.
And Jennifer.
That sounds good.
Okay.
Yeah. That's seven panel. There's seven people who are going to be a part of the panel. And I'm very excited to have everyone there, and very excited to have the event. So if you want to find out more, you can go to did you find it?
I found the list.
Okay.
At least as of a few days ago.
It hasn't changed.
Okay. Judith Ink, Vera Carius Kelly, Sienna Freeman Tolberg, Judy Patrick, Libby Post, Nick Rangel, Sarah Rogerson.
There you go. Okay. So that's our panel. It's going to be wonderful, and we hope that you can join us. Panel at WAMC.org if you want to send letters, but WAMC.org if you want to find out more information. You can go online and get your tickets that way, or you can give us a call, 1-800-323-9262. 1-800-323-9262. We would love to have you as part of our live program this Friday, 9 to 11. Doors open at 8:30. All right. Now, let's get going and talk to the group and find out who's here. We welcome Wall Street investment banker Mark Wittman. Good morning, Mark. How are you?
Morning, Joe.
Nice to have you with us. We welcome CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan. Long time no see. How are you?
I'm okay. Today is my first day of spring because we woke to our annual chicken slaughter. Fox. Terrible. Terrible. Yeah. So I had a fun morning.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
A carnage?
Yeah. There were four left. Yeah.
Out of how many?
12. Yeah.
Whoa. Yeah. One fox?
Yeah, big one. I saw him. I chased him off.
Well, of course, he's big now.
Yeah. Big, fluffy, like dog-sized fox.
Wow,
you know?
That is big.
Yeah, it was. But you know, I think I might be done with chickens. I go through this every year. I got these guys as chicks last April, so it's a bummer.
It's heartbreaking.
Yeah. It is, and it's I understand circle of life and all of that, but that's very sad. Well, thank you for being here under the circumstances. Appreciate it.
I'm not going to stay home and stare at the feathers.
Right. Or go to the Capitol and stare at the feathers.
Right. Yeah.
Being here is better than staying home and staring at the feathers. We're off to a good start.
You may change your mind about halfway through the program, but we'll see what happens. All right. Let's also go to Jim Ketterer is here, Senior Fellow, Bard Center for Civic Engagement. Jim, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for being here.
Good morning.
And last but certainly not least, Libby Post is here, a political consultant, lobbyist, dear friend. Hello, Libby. How are you?
I'm good.
Good to have you here. Of course, the big topic to talk about and what dominated headlines all weekend was the Iranian drone attack that took place. There were warnings, and then it happened. So there are many aspects to this, and I'll throw out a few of them, and then we'll go to our panel to discuss. And of course, we welcome your letters as well. The UN Security Council met Sunday to discuss Iran's first direct military attack on Israel, its decades-long foe. A majority of the Security Council members, including the United States, condemned the attack, urging Middle East leaders to avoid escalation of the six-month Israel-Gaza war. In its overnight attack, Iran sent more than 300 drones and missiles toward Israel, but did not cause major damage or injuries because of a U.S.-led coalition that destroyed most of the projectiles. Ambassadors for Iran, Syria, Russia, and China criticized the support of the United States and other countries that helped shoot down those missiles. The representatives also critiqued the Security Council for not condemning Israel's April 1st attack on an Iranian diplomatic compound, a strike that killed seven members of Iran's elite Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. More than 99% of the missiles and drones were intercepted, Israel Defense Forces spokesman Daniel Hagari said. A few fell inside Israeli territory, seriously injuring a young girl and causing minor damage to a military base. And now, with its first ever direct military attack on Israel, Iran crossed old red lines and created a precedent in its decades-long shadow war with the Jewish state. Iran decided to create a new equation, said the head of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps in an interview with state-run television on Sunday. From now on, if Israel attacks Iranian interests, figures, and citizens anywhere, we will retaliate from Iran. Arab nations also calling for restraint as the conflict intensifies. And we'll talk about all of this, and then as a separate topic, in just a bit, when we've touched the bases on this, I'd like to go to the U.S. role here and the Pentagon's role in defending Israel from Iranian attack, and also the political, what this means politically for President Biden. But let us first begin with the attack itself. Jim, it is, I guess we sort of feared this for a long time.
Yeah, because this has been going on a certain level for quite some time. This is an intensification of what was already a long-standing tit-for-tat, deadly but calibrated conflict going on between Israel and Iran. There's been all sorts of attacks from both sides over the last many, many years. Israel has carried out clandestine attacks, for instance, on a centrifuge at a nuclear site in Iran, assassination of scientists, attacking some of the Iranian proxies around the region. And Iran has used those proxies also in Lebanon, in Syria, in Yemen, and in Iraq. But this really, I think it's important to also keep in mind that the intensification, perhaps what's going to turn into an escalation, didn't start with this most recent attack. It also included in this was the attack that the Israelis carried out 2 weeks ago against an Iranian, what the Iranians are saying is a diplomatic site. We can talk about that. That's in dispute, but was an Iranian site in Syria, and that Israeli Air Force, F-35s, launched missiles at that site, killed 11 people, killed two important leaders from the Revolutionary Guard Corps, particularly one who's the head of something called the Al-Quds Force, which is a paramilitary intelligence operation that has been involved in many of the violent and disruptive activities around the region for many years. And so this attack kind of ramped up things because of the level of the people who were killed, particularly these two leaders, these military leaders who were there, but also because the Iranians are saying it was carried out on what they're calling a consulate. So it's a diplomatic facility. And in general, even among enemies, diplomatic facilities have been off limits. There is a treaty in place, the 1961 Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, for those of you who are keeping score at home. And there is this notion of extraterritoriality, which basically means that an embassy is the home territory of whoever's embassy that is in any of these diplomatic facilities. And this is, it sounds just kind of theoretical and perhaps some obscure, but it's very important in the conduct of diplomatic relations. And there's a reciprocity to it to make sure that everybody is keeping their diplomats safe, even when they're in places where they're otherwise in harm's way. Now, it gets complicated when they're military facilities that are included in one's definition of what's a diplomatic facility. But I can tell you from my experience that in our embassies around the world, there are military people, there are intelligence people, there are all kinds of people with different roles than just the classic diplomat. So this combination, the number of people killed, the use in the open of the Israeli Air Force, the level of them, all really made it very much almost a certainty that Iran was going to be responding and that they'd be responding in some way that also upped the ante in everything. But at the same time, this response was, though it was from Iran and also from Yemen, Syria, and Iraq, but not Lebanon, which I think was one of the ways they were calibrating back the Iranians, that it was massive. It projected military strength, but at the same time was telegraphed and was done in such a way that made it clear it could be thwarted.
As far as, and we'll talk more about the thwarting in a few minutes. Libby.
Well, you know, this is one more opportunity for some to ramp up the anti-Semitism in this country. And I think it's also an opportunity for Israel to show some restraint, which I think they are doing. I'm surprised that there hasn't been more of a retaliation, but I think Israel understands with the United States' support hanging in the balance that they really shouldn't go whole, for lack of a better word, whole hog and attack Iran. You know, when did you say there was a convention that you shouldn't be attacking other people's embassies?
It's been a longstanding practice, I mean, for centuries, but there was a specific one in 1961 in Vienna.
Okay, because I'm looking at a list. I'm looking at a list of lots of, since 1961, of lots of attacks on various embassies by other various countries. And
for sure. Sure it happens,
right.
But it crosses another line. And what I was just saying is that this has been deadly for a long time, but they've stayed within the guardrails of this conflict. And this was one of the things that, I mean, the Iranians, make no mistake, I mean, as I said, the Al-Quds force is behind many, many bad things.
Ours.
And no one should be rooting for them. But at the same time, the location of this attack, and the Israelis knew what they were doing, and there's a series of reasons behind it, but there's just no denying that it expanded the nature of the conflict.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that expansion was there regardless. I think that Iran's looking for an opportunity to do what they did. What I found interesting is that they let everybody know it was coming.
Yeah, they telegraphed it.
Right, they telegraphed it. They let everybody know it was coming. And so Israel could be prepared, and the United States and the other allies could be prepared to shoot almost all of these drones. And, I mean, when I saw cruise missiles, I was like, ooh, you know, that's pretty heavy duty, and ballistic missiles. You know, they could shoot them down, and one girl got injured, and there were no deaths, and which is a good thing. But I think that this is just another opportunity for Iran to do some saber rattling and to say, look, we're still here. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, Iran, you know, will say no, 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 but they have supported Hamas. They've supported Hezbollah. They did not want Israel and Saudi Arabia to have domestic relations or, you know, relationship, and that's what one of the main reasons for October 7th is because they were at the precipice of that. October 7th happened, and that went away. And Iran, you know, is a country that just wants to inflict its version of religious law on the rest of the world. And, you know, I don't think that that's really going to happen, but I do think that this is a warning sign and it's a shot across the bow.
I would just add one other thing, too, and it's also a reflection of the contested nature of domestic politics inside Iran. Yeah. And we have seen certain elements of the hardliners that are ascendant and need to, you know, they are demanding that they see strong action in response to these sorts of things. And things were ramping up even before, as you mm-hmm. said, even before the attack on the Iranian consulate slash not a consulate in Syria.
Heather.
A couple of things I would add. I mean, I don't have a lot to add because this is a very, I think, very well thought out discussion. But one, I thought it was fascinating that before it was even over, there was a statement from an official from Iran saying this matter is concluded, which I that is sort of a like, hey, you know, we're just doing this to retaliate because we have to retaliate, but we gave you all this notice, and so we're not like Hamas in the respect of we're not this is not a surprise attack. This is something that we're forced to do because of the rules somehow of diplomat or of conflict, which I first off, I'm going to just call a little BS on that. I mean, I think that they were intentionally, if that was the case, they wouldn't have shot 300 projectiles. They could have done it with 100 or 50 or something, you know. I question whether or not this really is concluded. There does seem to be, to me, a little bit of trying to wear down the allies of Israel so that at some point there can be a follow-up to go in. And obviously the objective of many of Israel's neighbors is for them not to exist. So mm-hmm. I don't think that objective goes away. And I don't believe the statement of the Iranian official, this matter is concluded. I don't think this is ever concluded. But I am very concerned about the impact it will have on the American electorate and our view. I mean, before this was even finished, all over social media are memes like, oh, this wouldn't have happened, you know, during a Trump presidency because he's so... You know, he's like Oz now. You know,
yeah, and Putin's the man behind the curtain,
right? And I just I am very fearful when we live in a country where you know, in certain demographics, people get most of their news from TikTok, which is on a you know, it works off of a program that basically gives you what you agree with,
right?
So I think it's going to probably have some impact on our, you know, on our electoral, the viewpoint, certainly of the people who were leaning one way or another. And it's very concerning to me because it's so much of this feels very intentional and staged. And I'm not articulating that well other than, you know, the whole like, this matter is concluded. I was like, really? Oh, you know, like, okay, we're even now. I don't think that's the case.
This matter won't be concluded for them until there's no Jews left on the planet.
Right, that's my point.
Let's be honest about that.
And so I think it's very disingenuous, and
yes.
I think that I'm personally concerned about a follow-up. I do say I was happy that Israel didn't retaliate immediately, but I think they're also highlighting there's a big difference between, you know, a surprise slaughter,
right?
And you know, something that's been telegraphed, and by the way, it gave Israel the opportunity to show the strength of their allies.
Yeah.
Mark, we're going to take a break in just a few minutes. I want to get Mark's comments before we do that. We also welcome your letters, anything that you're listening to and you'd like to comment on or have a question. All you have to do is write to us, panel at wamc.org. Mark Whitman.
A couple additional thoughts. Iran crossed a very important line here when it directly attacked Israel from its territory. It's only the second time Israel's been fired upon by a state actor. The other time was the Saddam Hussein during the Gulf War. And if you remember at the time, eventually, modern time, sorry.
Well, I mean, you know, you do have the Six-Day War. You have the Yom Kippur War in 73.
Right, but recently fired upon by a state actor. The other time, their more recent time, was Saddam Hussein during his initial foray into Kuwait. And Israel was eventually convinced not to retaliate because there was a coalition of forces arrayed against Iraq already. But in crossing this serious line, Iran made three mistakes. Number one, if this was supposed to show deterrence, they were sort of going for a Goldilocks approach. They certainly wanted to do something meaningful, but imagine if we'd have woken to significant death and destruction, we'd now be talking about a much different scenario and a much different U.S. posture. Iran knew that, but frankly, that you could argue, as happy as we are that nothing happened, that this doesn't show much in the way of military deterrence if 99% of what they put up in the air was shot down. Secondly, they, at a time when Benjamin Netanyahu and Israel were becoming ever more ostracized amongst their own allies, Iran just basically allowed those allies to coalesce and support around Israel almost instantaneously. So they made a serious mistake there. Now, I don't believe Iran when they say they care about the Palestinians, but to the extent that they want to keep that facade up, they've also immediately demoted the cause of the Palestinians in Gaza. So I think the line that's been crossed here is critical. And I actually think, given, and we'll talk more about the U.S. response, I think that the fact that Iran's headed towards nuclear capabilities and the fact that they've now fired from their own territory into Israel is something that literally can never be forgotten. But I do think it's an issue that can, and for a number of issues we'll talk about in a bit, should be tabled for the meantime. And I'm so glad that Joe Biden's in the White House, because at least cooler heads will prevail in the short run here.
Great way to end this segment. We will take a break. When we come back, we welcome your thoughts, panel at WAMC.org, and we will talk about the U.S. response as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, Jim Ketterer, Heather Mulligan, Libby Post, and Mark Whitman. I'm Joe Donahue. Your letters and more after this. It is a busy news day, and we have a lot to talk about. We're starting off with world leaders urging restraint as Israel weighs retaliation against Iran. We heard the opening statements from our panelists, and we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Jim.
Yeah, just about, what Heather mentioned is very important, that the Iranians were almost, as it was still going on, saying, well, this is the conclusion of this. And I certainly don't think it's the conclusion of the conflict. I think what the Iranians are trying to signal, and I think maybe what the Israelis are trying to signal now too, as they gauge what they're going to do next, is that it's bringing it back to the calibrated conflict that existed before. But I don't think anybody would think that the conflict will just be over. It's just going to bring it back. And I think if there is an Israeli response, it will be one that will say, we're going to respond, but we're going to do so under the rules of the game we were playing a few weeks ago. In terms of the allies that Heather was also mentioning, Jordan was involved in a way in this, and they shot down a missile or maybe more that was over Jordanian territory. And there's already been, it highlights the difficulty of being an Arab state and having a peace treaty with Israel and being an ally and then getting drawn into one of these things. So they did do that. They have this peace treaty in place for a long time, since I think 1994. But the regional and domestic response to the Jordanian government has been very tough. And so that's yet another moving part to this. And then the last thing I would say is, it seems that the Iranians purposely sent the drones that were easiest to shoot down, and they didn't send the most advanced drones. So I'm not sure that it wasn't designed to be a test of their most advanced weaponry. It was certainly designed to signal to many different audiences, including their hardliners at home, but by all accounts, they still have their most advanced tech in reserve.
In reading from the New York Times, Arab countries from the United Arab Emirates and Oman to Jordan and Egypt have tried for months to tamp down the conflict between Israel and Hamas, especially after it widened to include armed groups backed by Iran and embedded deep within the Arab world. Some of them, like the Houthis, threaten Arab governments as well. But the Iranian drone and missile attack on Israel over the weekend, which put the entire region on alert, made the new reality unavoidable. Unlike past Israeli-Palestinian conflicts, and even those involving Israel and Lebanon or Syria, this one keeps expanding. Part of why these wars were contained was that they were not a direct confrontation between Israel and Iran, says Rhonda Slim, a senior fellow at the Washington-based Middle East Institute. But now we are entering this era where a direct confrontation between Israel and Iran that could drag the region into conflict and that could drag the U.S. in, now that prospect of a regional war is going to be on the table all the time. Do you agree with that, Jim?
Yeah. I mean, I think also one part of what you just read, too, about the Arab states, I've seen in some of the reporting since the Iranian attack, is a lack of understanding that a lot of the Arab states are not good buddies with the Iranians, to put it mildly. And so it puts them in a very difficult spot, as the Jordanian example that I just mentioned, because there's such a tsunami of anger across the Arab world right now about the situation in Gaza that anything that makes it look like an Arab government is aligning with Israel, even against another enemy, Iran, puts them really betwixt and between a variety of really hard choices.
I think Jordan has the added issue of they get, I think, like 90% of their water from Israel. And it's so they are extremely dependent on Israel for drinking water. Israel is very, very advanced in desalination, reclaiming water, reusing water, to the point where they are an actual exporter in the region. So I would think that would be at least to some degree incentive for them to at least make a show of being aligned with Israel.
Yeah, that's a good point. And people lose sight of the fact that oftentimes in the Middle East, people think about oil, but water is also a very powerful tool.
Mark or Libby?
I do think it's interesting, you know, Joe, early in this conflict, and I think this is a microcosm of where the Arabs are with respect to Israel and Iran. Early in the conflict, the Houthis were firing, and I don't remember if it was rockets or missiles, so projectiles at Israel, and it didn't go reported widely, but Saudi Arabia was shooting them down. And there's a reason it didn't go reported widely, which is, I think, the microcosm is Saudi Arabia would like to be on side with a more practical, liberal government in Iran. When I say liberal, I mean sort of an MBS liberal. I don't mean a democratic liberal. And they think there's a prospect of that in the not-too-distant future. And in the meantime, they fear Iran, but they can't be seen. Even the royal family in Saudi Arabia cannot be seen by the people on the street in Saudi Arabia as being in allegiance with Israel. That's politically untenable. And I do think that's a further... You could either call it a miscalculation on the part of the Iranian regime, or you could actually call it, as I think Jim was referring to, as one of the motivations for the fact that they did step things up. I think there's a hardline regime there that knows that there's a change that's going to happen very soon because of the age of the current leader. There's the expectation that they're going to liberalize. And hardline regimes can be very powerful, but as we know in Russia and elsewhere, they're also very brittle. And so I think what you saw here was a bit of a gasp from the hardliners trying to entrench their power. And they're hoping, I think they sent 350 missiles because they did the calculations based on rates over in the Ukraine, and they figured they'd get more through. But the incredible thing was that the wide coalition, including the United States, which shot down almost a third of what went in the air, was far more effective than I think the Iranians anticipated. So they've got to sell to their populace the sort of the fireworks, but not the actual damage that they did. and that's the best they can do. But again, I think you're seeing a last gasp from the hardliners. But unfortunately, I think it's a line that was crossed that was so important that in the long run, we can't ignore it. And we'll get to that when we talk about the U.S. government's response.
Do we think that this will draw down some of the calls for Netanyahu's resignation? I mean, I just wonder
if he plays it right. Now, maybe we should get into this, but if I'm Biden, you know, Biden was reported as saying we won't participate in a military response to this. And what he doesn't want is Netanyahu working with what I'll call house money because of our defense there. And he's already played with house money. There's no way you can't convince me that the initial strike on the embassy compound in Syria wasn't in part motivated by Netanyahu as number one, gee, let's see what happens, because the more turmoil that's going on, the more valuable I am to my country potentially. And number two, you know, I'm going to pick on the bully in my class because my big brother from high school is still on the playground, meaning we still had our military assets, the naval assets there, which turned out to be invaluable over the weekend. So Netanyahu's already playing with house money. And one of the constraints that Biden has to put on him is to get him to stop doing that, because if he thinks he can do more of it, anytime he thinks his legitimacy or his government's at serious risk, he's going to try and make himself invaluable. And that may include stepping up conflicts other than in just Gaza, frankly. I think the initial attack was clearly motivated by that. And I think that's the tension that Biden has to play with now.
Libby?
You know, it's interesting to hear Mark talk, because when October 7th
always
happened.
Always,
right? When but when October 7th happened, and before we heard the horrors of it, you know, Netanyahu was having a lot of problems at home. And so I thought, well, you know, maybe there was something going on here. And then it all played out, and that was clearly not the case. I mean, if it was the case, he should be drawn and quartered. But, you know, this also, he, you know, could have been something orchestrated in a way where, and we'll never know what goes on really behind closed doors and in on those red phones and all the rest of it. But it was just so well planned, in the sense that Israel was able to fight it off, right? And the United States was able to play its role. And it was telegraphed. I mean, who telegraphs an attack like that?
Oh, no, I think they had to, Libby, because
why?
Had they been successful, we would now be incinerating. We, as in us and Israel, would now be incinerating. And the Iranian government knows that. They wanted to walk up to the line, maybe put a foot over it, but they didn't want to cause carnage in Israel. They wanted to.
No, I think they do want to cause carnage in Israel. I think they did not want to start World War III right now.
Well, they don't want to cause carnage in Israel today because they would lose.
Yeah.
The problem Iran has is once the United States decides it can't but get involved, we will take the can opener and we will make sure that they have no nuclear capability left. We will bomb that mountainside, right, until it is a deep, deep valley. And the Iranians know that.
Right.
And that would cause the fall of that extremist government. Now, what happens afterward, gosh only knows, but...
Well, I remember when the Shah fell. I was at the University of Buffalo, and there were Iranian students. I lived in the international dorm. And they were all excited because they thought it was going to be opening up a new era of liberalism. And then, you know, and then...
Not.
Right. then not.
And one should not lose sight of how horrible the Shah's regime was.
Right.
And who put the Shah in power?
Right, we did.
The United States did.
But the fact of the matter is, I'm not convinced that if this Iranian regime goes down, that it's not going to be replaced by someone even more hardline. I don't care if there's liberal elements and wanting reform in Iran. I think that the religious police are the ones really in control, and it will be even harsher than it is now.
Yeah, look, there's a change coming in Iran within regimes. And frankly, if you're the United States and frankly even other Arab states, even if it's coin flip, if you're convinced that Iran doesn't have offensive nuclear weapons capabilities before the coin flips, you let it flip and hope it comes down on your side, because that's that would potentially solve one of the most serious geopolitical problems on this planet. If it comes down the other way, particularly given what just happened this weekend, we're going to have, you know, a serious military effort in front of us, us being at least Israel and the United States in the not too distant future, in the intermediate future of the world.
All right. Let's go to some letters that will bring us up to the top of the hour, and then we'll talk about other aspects of this story in just a moment. Iran's telegraph of their attack was reminiscent of the Cold War. The Iranians could not afford a nuclear response from Israel in a surprise attack, so they telegraphed their response. Israel is a nuclear-armed adversary, and it seems like Iran must have had some kind of nuclear assurances from an ally like Russia or China to dare launch an attack of this size. That from Jason. Then I will no longer contribute or listen to the roundtable due to too little fair coverage on both sides of the conflict in Gaza. One panelist should not be the only provider of their opinionated, biased pseudo-analysis. I'll let you fight over as to who that is. And then some people in the room, their feelings are hurt that it's not them. Deanne says,
No, I think we should tell the listeners that two people who were
in
opposition a little bit in the last exchange just raised their hand.
Right. Deanne says, my concern regarding Israel is that because they get so much money, armaments, and support from the United States, my concern is that Israel will think they can do whatever they want in terms of attacking Iran's embassy or whatever it was. I think Netanyahu will do whatever it takes to stay in power. I don't want to support them no matter what they do.
They already did not retaliate.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, don't forget, we're, you know, in a different time zone here, but this all happened and there hasn't been this massive retaliation from it. I think they did say that they would respond in time,
in the time of their choosing, or something, time and place of their choosing, and I think that that will probably literally be true. Reverting again to the rules of the old tit for tat game, I suspect that you will find that one of the nuclear facilities will be in Iran. We'll have another clandestine attack. These things have already happened. They've already happened in the past, or a scientist will be assassinated, or something like that. The Iranians could also revert to their old playbook, which is carrying out attacks around the region or even outside the region, attacking Israeli or Jewish facilities in Latin America, as they've done before. I wouldn't be surprised. I certainly hope it doesn't happen, but I wouldn't be surprised if they engineer an attack in Jordan that would then put the Jordanian government under tremendous pressure.
John writes to us, and these are two questions for Libby. First, if the Palestinian people were given a choice between living in peace and prosperity or continuing the blood feud, which would they choose? Second, if Israel had never been established, would the Middle East be a totally peaceable kingdom?
Well, first of all, I think the Palestinians would like to live in peace and freedom. Okay, unless you're Saddam Hussein type, or, you know, some of these other demagogues, I think everybody wants to live in peace and freedom and prosperity and be able to raise their family and, you know, have a nice life. The second question, can you ask the second question again?
Well, I can find it, sure.
If Israel wasn't in existence, would it be peaceful in the Middle East?
Oh. Yes, and a peaceable kingdom.
I certainly hope that the writer doesn't think that, oh, let's just get rid of Israel and then everything will be okay, because that's a pretty simplistic perspective on a very complicated situation. If Israel wasn't there, I think people always find a reason to fight because they want to, because there's territory, there's territorialism, there's whose version of their particular religion is better. You know, so I don't know if the Middle East would be, you know, goodness and light. I don't think anybody really knows, but I think it's sort of naive to think and to blame Israel for all the conflict just because it exists. Look at the map, folks. Just look at the map.
And there would be no democracy. There would be no freedom.
Right.
There would
sure.
be no rights for women.
Right.
There would be no rights for people who were not heterosexual.
Right.
I mean, I've been to Israel. Israel is a place where people can you can go to the Wailing Wall and you can see people coexisting who are, you know, overtly wearing their religious garb of multiple different religions. And that is the only place in this part of the world that you can do that.
Yeah, I mean, the women at the wall aren't necessarily always
no,
welcome,
no,
but,
no, but yeah. My point is, I mean, yeah. I was actually surprised when, you know, there's these little shops that sell trinkets and you can go into one of them and they'll have trinkets that are like, Jesus is my homeboy. And, you know, and then there's
and Moses
know,
is my
right.
My, yeah.
right. But it's the same shop.
My captain. Right,
that
yeah.
that would not exist anywhere yes. else right. in that part of the world. And I was born in North Africa in Tunisia. I was there as a young adult when it was relatively free. It is not anymore. When I was there, as a 17-year-old female, I could walk around wearing shorts. Not permitted anymore.
Right.
I used to be a bastion of European tourism. And what has happened is the much more conservative religious elements have gained ground in these governments, and they have taken rights away from people. And it's, you know, it's happened across North Africa. And it's
that's their game plan is
yeah.
to take people's rights away. And but really, take a look at the map, right? Israel's the size of Jersey.
Yeah.
And then you've got hundreds and thousands of square miles of Arab countries surrounding it.
We have to take a break. We're late for news. We'll come back. We'll continue our conversation. Jim Ketterer, Heather Mulligan, Libby Post, Mark Whitman, and for whatever you do, do not forget, Jesus is my homeboy. We'll be back right after this.
So sorry for your trouble. Tell me to take a walk. And I would understand. Of course it's good to talk. You take my handkerchief. No, I don't need it back. Please don't worry.
I realize I haven't told you who our music is responsible for music this morning. Mark Knopfler is the artist. The new album is One Deep River, and it is out. And you can see all the tracks that we played throughout the panel portion by going to wamc.org/roundtable. The playlist is posted there. WAMC.org/roundtable. All right. Let us talk for a moment about the U.S. and what they did on all of this. As Iran launched its much-anticipated attack on Israel on Saturday, the night sky was filled with deadly threats. More than 100 ballistic missiles were fired, senior U.S. officials say, complementing about 30 cruise missiles and more than 150 explosive drones. Israel's vaunted missile defense systems ramped up to engage the munitions as they were launched from Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen. But they were flanked by U.S. and British fighter jets, a Patriot missile defense system manned by U.S. troops in Iraq, and U.S. destroyers off the coast of Israel, each ready to assist. The result, a senior Biden administration official said Sunday, was a spectacular defeat of Iran's attack, even though it was larger than U.S. officials had anticipated. I would like to move the conversation to the point of the Biden administration and their handling of this. And again, we'll go to letters in just a moment. I do think as all this was going on, I would like to mention this of the release that was put out by Elise Stefanik on Saturday night, saying, quote, Joe Biden's catastrophic weakness on the world stage and his failure to support Israel, our most precious ally, emboldened Iran to launch a direct attack on Israel. As soon as Joe Biden took office, he reversed President Trump's maximum pressure campaign on Iran and less than 6 months ago, he allowed critical international sanctions on Iran's missile and drone programs to expire, empowering Iran to launch this massive strike. The U.S. must stand with Israel and offer our unwavering support. How is what we did not support?
But you also have a Democratic senator from Pennsylvania, Senator Fetterman, also saying that the administration should not be conditioning support of Israel, and that we shouldn't be offering what my friend Stephen Cook at the Council on Foreign Relations has said is a yellow light, not a red light to Israel, but certainly not a green light on retaliation. So, you know, I think this highlights also a lot of roiling in the Democratic Party over how to deal with the Middle East.
I just when I heard Lawler say something this weekend, and I look, some of what Stefanik's criticism, factually, it's true the Biden administration has loosened up a little bit on Iran, and I'll be blunt. I think it's to help world oil prices behave while he's running for president. But in terms of assigning responsibility of this, I just wonder, someone should ask Lee Stefanik, Lawler, some of these others, how in the hell do you sleep at night? You turn down the aid package to Israel, to Taiwan, and Ukraine because it had in it something that you had asked for. And literally, people around the world, particularly in Ukraine, are dying as a result. No wonder so many of your colleagues are deciding, I can't keep this up. We talk about, oh, it's hard to raise funds, it's not fair. I bet you if you got truth serum into a lot of the levers, they would tell you that ethically and morally, it's just repugnant. And for those that stay and then just repeat this drivel, I just one question. How in the hell do you sleep at night? That's what I'd like to know from these people.
With a power
blanket.
Sorry,
I got mad, but I'm just tired.
No, with a either.
Gee, that's not what I was trying to stoke at all.
Yeah,
they sleep with either a power blanket wrapped around them, right, and so they feel secure in the power they have, or a I want power blanket wrapped around them, and it goes. So truth has nothing to do with these people. Truth has nothing to do with Elise Stefanik. Almost everything that comes out of her mouth is twisted to help the orange menace. I mean, that's all it is. And you know, the fact of the matter is that Biden did what he needed to do. He was clear with Israel they needed to back off on the Palestinian front. And they have, to a degree, not as much as many of us would like to see. And he was clear: you cannot retaliate, but we're your ally here, and we're going to help you to make sure none of those missiles make it onto your mainland. And so, you know, this is all political posturing for November. Nothing more, nothing less. And, you know, yes, I don't know how she sleeps at night either, but I guess it's pretty well because she doesn't seem to have any bags under her eyes.
Those of us who are honest thinking people do need to think about some of the nuances here. It's not an accident that Iran, when they had the opportunity, took a Portuguese flag vessel, right? They're trying to send a signal, and they're sending a signal to Biden that Biden should listen to, which is, if you make this too ugly, you're going to have an oil price problem on the eve of an election. And guess what? When you're trying to defend democracy against people like we've just discussed, I'm okay for playing things in the international world one way or the other because there is a greater good involved here. So I do think that those of us who are honest and thinking human beings need to understand there are tons of subtleties involved in all these questions. But I'm just tired of hearing it from these Republicans. And their moral responsibility, let's leave aside the moral responsibility around January 6th.
Yeah, right.
Right? And let's just focus on how, you know, look at what's happening in Ukraine. You have the power to stop it. And look at the Speaker Johnson. Look, I'm not a person to judge anybody's relationship with the deity of their choice, but his view of his deity and what matters to his deity is one I can't comprehend when you let other human beings die at the hand of a tyrant for political expediency. I don't get it.
I think Lawler actually was the one who signed the discharge petition to try and get the vote on the aid bill.
The quote I heard from Lawler this weekend basically blame the Biden administration for the fact that there's been a delay in aid because they haven't done what they needed to do with respect to the border. It was baloney, what I heard. Now, maybe at other times he said things that are correct, and perhaps I misheard him. But if I heard him correctly, what he said to me, I mean, it angered me because that guy, I actually think he has a brain. And my normal presumption is that people who have the ability to see right and wrong are even more responsible for their actions in the world than perhaps some of those who don't.
He does have a brain, but he's also up for re-election. And so he is going to shore up that Trumpian base, which is what helped him get elected the first time, in a very thin margin. And he's up against the same guy. So it's going to be really interesting to see how all of that.
Is he an election denier?
He's no, he's not. No. And he's unequivocally pro-Israel. I mean, has been from day one.
Yeah.
Unequivocally.
I have
But he's toeing the line around Ukraine. You know, and he's skirting the whole, the Republicans are in love with Putin thing.
Can I just mention also, Mark had talked about something that we hadn't mentioned before, and I think we shouldn't overlook it, and that is the seizing of this ship. And so that in and of itself, it might be problematic on a micro level, but it also highlights on a macro level the continued importance of being able to freely navigate those waterways. And that has not been the case since the Houthis have ramped up their activities. And I think dealing with the Houthis is one of those things where you see the limits of American power, though we've seen the real value of American power in helping to thwart this Iranian attack. Our attacks on the Houthis haven't really diminished their capacity at all to wreak havoc on the navigation of these waterways and the ability to have international shipping use the Suez Canal at its full capacity. And that is a major problem.
I also, and I know this is a minor thing, but this is to Mark's statement of how the hell do you sleep at night. But the Stefanik press release just does remind you that there was a time in American politics where if you were a Republican or a Democrat, as there was a military operation going on at that very moment, you would shut up.
That's right.
And at very least, defend the country and what we were doing at that moment. Plenty of time to armchair quarterback. But to have it happen as bombs are falling, it does bring you back to a time and to give you an idea of how things have changed.
Yeah, I mean, this started, I think this disrespect for authority started with when Obama was in office, because we had a black man in the White House, and there were a lot of people who didn't like that and remember the guy who yelled out, "You're lying," or "You're a liar," or whatever, you know. But, you know, when I was a kid and the Vietnam War was going on, there was plenty of protest. You know, but we stood together as a country when we needed to. You know, 9/11, we stood together as a country because we needed to. But that's, I can't see that happening now, even if there was some kind of catastrophe, because what would happen is the right would just blame Joe Biden for whatever it was that happened. And they would say, and it would never happen if Trump was in office, which we all know just isn't true. And I just want to correct myself. Mondaire Jones is the person who's running against Mike Lawler. And Mondaire Jones used to be in Congress. You know, he lost in the last cycle.
He got redistricted out.
Yeah, he got redistricted out, right? And then, Lawler beat Sean Patrick Maloney, who didn't take it at all seriously. And this is going to be a contested race. The DCCC is putting money into Jones. They know he's a proven vote getter. He's personable. He's likable. And so it's going to be quite the race. And the other races in the Mid-Hudson Valley, the Molinaro-Riley race.
I didn't know who Lawler was that well. And then when I heard him this weekend, I know all I need to know about him. And I will tell you, when Mondaire Jones lost his seat, he moved down to Brooklyn, right, and ran. But he effectively was redistricted out of his natural geographic territory, if you will. When he lost that election on that morning, I did say on this show that it was really sad for me because he's the kind of guy that we need folks like him mm-hmm. in government. And we clearly don't need people like Mike Lawler anywhere near the seat of power.
No,
frankly.
Lawler used to be in the assembly.
See, I disagree. I think Lawler is one of the most moderate members of the House Republicans. He's been the one leading the charge on bipartisan legislation. He was one of the key influencers in the Ukraine border deal bill that ultimately did not go. He was the one who was opposed to removing Mike Johnson. He thought that Marjorie Taylor Greene's petition was absurd. He's been very outspoken about that, and I think he has really established himself as sort of a what we need more of in the Republican Party, which is common sense, kind of middle of the road. And so I just couldn't disagree more, because he is not a member of the sort of more lunatic fringe of that party at all.
If a man that alleges that support for Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan would have passed if only the Biden administration would have supported border security is what you consider moderate, I don't need any of them.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying his track record is not one of the extreme far right.
Right. And Mark, I mean, I get what Heather's saying. You know, he is a Republican, but all of this rhetoric, it's about November. It has very little to do with his real stance. It's about getting reelected.
Doesn't that count?
Yeah, it does. It does count, absolutely. And people will decide whether they're going to vote for him. I don't know if this is your district or not, but will decide whether or not to vote for him based on this rhetoric. But he's truly trying to just attack Biden so that the Trumpers will come out and vote for him, because he's not that right wing ideologue like some of these other people are, like a Marjorie Taylor Greene. And so he's trying to shore up that base a little bit. I'm not saying right or wrong. I'm just giving you this, that's what he's trying to do.
I think that because every member of the House is up for election, that it really is incumbent on, so to speak, on constituents to ask them on the issues that matter to them. And so this is the one that we're talking about now. Where do you stand? And get them past talking points and say, well, what will you really do? What will you do as a member of the House of Representatives on the issue of Ukraine, Gaza, dealing with Iran, and then Taiwan, I guess, came up in this mix as well. Don't talk to us about an unrelated issue, the border security. That's another issue that I think every member should be asked about. But like, what will you specifically do? And if constituents don't do that, we're just going to be continuing to just hear from all members just this usual kind of blah, 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 because they can get away with it. And they will get away with it until they can't. And the only people who can really make that difference are constituents.
I started, when we started talking about this, I asked the question as in reading the and we got there. We got there. I'm just going back to this because we were talking about overall support, but of looking at Elise Stefanik's statement and blaming Biden and so forth. So the line, as I said at the time, that struck me was that, you know, we need to support. And I'm just wondering, given what we did, given the amount of assistance that was given to intercept what was falling on Israel, how is that not support? And what more can this president do in addition to trying, like much of the rest of the world, to calm down Israel and say, wait a minute before you retaliate?
Oh, I if I were Joe Biden, I think he's done a lot of this. First of all, he went to the G7. Why is he doing that? Even to the United Nations, despite the fact that people like John Bolton quickly dismissed that. He did that because in 91 he saw when Israel feels supported by its allies, it's less likely to act on its own. It's less likely to act to extremes on its own. He needs to call up Benjamin Netanyahu and, as he's already did, say, I'm not going to participate in any offensive retaliation. As my colleague has suggested, he needs to tell him anything you do needs to be inside the lines. My understanding is the next morning Hezbollah was firing rockets. Perhaps that provides an opportunity. Because, by the way, if he does something, let's say, against Iran or sorry, Hezbollah, and Iran responds directly again, and he's forced to respond, any degradation in Hezbollah's capability in the meantime accrues to his benefit. So I'd try to get Netanyahu inside the lines. I'd also tell him, look, you've still not finished your homework, son, so you're not going to turn on the TV. And what I mean by that is Gaza. I actually understand the Israeli position that, let's just play this if we were Americans. If Osama bin Laden had taken hostages and still had maybe 50 or so of them alive and was in a mountain somewhere and there were a bunch of civilians in the way, we would send the U.S. military in to sort it out as best we could, but make sure we finished it. Biden needs to say, look, you've got to be far, far, far more careful in Rafah than you've been before. But the fact that you may want to try and get the last couple brigades of Hamas that are in there, when I say last couple, at least the ones that they know about, that's not to say I think they're going to be eliminated. And the leadership, probably Yahya Sinwar is part of it. If I'm Biden, I say I get that if you do it the right way. And by the way, in the meantime, you still need to feed the Gazans, for God's sake. You can't have famine in there. And I actually think that benefits the Israelis when you do that. In the past, the United States has helped them find sort of political exits. If they need to blame some of the fact that they're moderating their retaliation on their big brother, the United States, be that source of blame. But I think, and if you're Biden, by the way, you can't stomach a conflict with Iran, because if oil prices spike, you won't be the next president. Do I think it's somewhat cynical? Yes. But when Donald Trump's your opponent, am I okay with that trade-off? You bet I am. I'm okay with you watching that consideration in the world. So I think the Biden thus far seems to be headed down the right way. I think there are definite signs you need to give to Israel. And I think there's plenty they need to do besides attacking the Iranians directly.
Anna writes, we as a nation are still forgetting the U.S. interference in Iran's newly elected democratic government in 1954, which is one of the original causes of the present situation we're all in. We essentially installed the Shah, supported him, thus causing the 78-79 revolt, which, yes, turned out radically different than many hoped and expected, which...
Yeah, I think it's a nice history lesson, but you...
Well, I think we mentioned it already.
Yeah, I think we did talk about it, actually.
But you also have to stop. The fact that whatever the hell happened in
54.
Doesn't mean that the actor then can take any action they want on the world stage with impunity or without us saying that there are moral and ethical limits.
Well, you just tell that to Arizona, where 1864 is
right.
The law of the land.
Right, right.
We're gonna...
time zones.
Right, exactly.
It's like 3 hours in California. It's like
150 years right.
in Arizona.
All right. We're going to take a break. We're going to move on to a topic. It's 10:29 on a Monday morning. Do you know where your former president of the United States is? Yeah, he's in court. We'll
Yay.
Talk about that and much more as we continue our conversation this morning. Jim Ketterer, Heather Mulligan, Libby Post, Mark Whitman, and we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will continue and wrap up the panel right after this.
When the thunder bursts in the velvet night, there's joy in one.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. Oh, see how much fun it is to be a panelist in this show. Everyone's laughing, having a great time. We welcome you, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And it is very, very nice to have you with us. We're going to move on to other subjects because we have about 15 minutes and there certainly are other things to talk about. So we'll do exactly that. As I mentioned, the Trump trial is about to begin. I think jury selection is going on as we speak. Donald J. Trump and his lawyers realize his chances in the courtroom are dicey, and he intends to make whatever happens a political triumph. That's the game plan. The first criminal trial of Donald Trump begins today, and the 45th president thinks he can win no matter what the jury decides. Mr. Trump will aim to spin any outcome to his benefit, and if convicted, to become the first felon to win the White House. We all have dreams and aspirations.
Mm-hmm.
Manhattan prosecutors who have accused Mr. Trump of falsifying records to cover up a sex scandal hold advantages that include a list of insider witnesses and a jury pool drawn from one of the country's most liberal counties. Mr. Trump and some aides and lawyers privately concede that a jury is unlikely to outright acquit him, according to people with knowledge of the discussions. All of this taking place today after three separate attempts just last week to have this trial either moved or done away with altogether were voted down by the judge. Mr. Trump, the presumptive 2024 Republican nominee, is seeking to write his own reality, telling a story that he believes could pave the return to the White House. He has framed his failed efforts to delay the case as evidence he cannot receive a fair trial, casting himself as a political martyr under attack from the prosecution and the judge. So, you know, like always, to pull off an acquittal, he is considering testifying to personally persuade jurors of his innocence. It would be a rare and risky move for most defendants, but Mr. Trump is putting his own stamp on the role, attacking the district attorney who brought the case, Alvin Bragg, with all the power of his bully pulpit. That behavior and its aftershocks are expected to continue throughout a weeks-long trial. Heather.
This would be even better than the OJ trial, I think, if it was televised. I mean, first off, I am trying to imagine how you can possibly find an impartial jury. And from what I understand, I mean, some of the questions are going to be, if you're the prosecution, you're going to ask someone who's been called in for jury duty, you know, are you a supporter of Donald Trump? And anyone who raises their hand is going to be immediately dismissed, to which point the defense will then ask, are you a supporter of Biden or are you not a supporter of Trump? And anyone who raises their hand
Democrat
is going to be dismissed, right? If you're a Democrat, maybe. I mean, there are so many potential issues for an appeal here, even just based on the jury selection alone. I think this would be one of the most heavily watched trials ever. If it was on television. I mean, even OJ, and I don't know. I mean, I watched a lot of the OJ trial, and there were parts of it that were, like, mind-numbingly boring, but I still watched it. I think this would be of even greater interest to people on both sides of the aisle. So my whole comment on it is, A, I don't think you can find an impartial jury. I think that no matter what they end up with, that aspect of it by itself will be appealed. B, I think it would be so entertaining if former President Trump were to testify. And gosh, I hope there's someone taking copious notes for every word and every facial expression. I don't think he will. I'm a former criminal defense attorney, and he has never actually listened to his attorneys, actually probably almost never. So, you know, maybe he would override their advice not to testify, but there's a lot of risk when you take the stand and you're under oath. And in his situation, I think even greater risk, because he tends to go off script quite a bit.
Well, he doesn't know what taking an oath means.
But anyways, I wish we could watch it. I guess that's my, and I know people are going to be mad at me for saying that, but
I think it's like if we had the opportunity to watch this. All those middle, that 30% middle of the road, no party people, you know, get to watch who he really is. You know, it would be interesting to see what their response would be. Now, I think this is going to be, you know, I agree that it's going to be hard to seat an impartial jury. But I think they'll probably get there at some point, finding some 12 people who are not all that engaged in politics and not reading the newspaper, because there are plenty of people who don't. But I agree with you, Heather. I would like to watch this one.
I mean, I think no matter what happens, it's going to get appealed. If they can get to the end without a mistrial because of some shenanigans in the courtroom, I think it'll get appealed. I mean, he's not going to be incarcerated at the time of the election, even if he were to be convicted. I think the jury selection in and of itself is going to be so challenging.
Well, I just remember being on the panel with John Faso here, and he just downplayed the significance of this case, and that that Bragg really didn't have much to stand on, and blah 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 blah. And I think the more you hear that from the Republicans and the people who support Trump, the more it means that, yeah, this is a dangerous case for Trump, and this could be incredibly damaging.
I agree, except when you go into it with, even if I lose, I win.
Well, that's his perspective, because he wants to get reelected, but he wants the headlines.
Well, he wants the headlines, but he also wants the money.
It's so easy to marginalize the motivation behind it. I mean, it took a long time to bring this case. And you can argue the timing is such that it's intended to, to damage his presidential prospects, and maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But there's a lot of narrative, and I can understand trying to frame it as, this isn't real, this is politically motivated, it's still an illegal thing. It would be, if you wanted absolute purity, you'd find an unelected prosecutor people with no political affiliations, and you would have tried it immediately after the allegation came out. But there are talking points for the Republican side of the aisle to sort of minimize the impact of the trial. I am just the absolute circus of it is just something that I find really interesting culturally. But
and Trump learned at the side of Roy Cohn.
That's right.
And this is right out of the Roy Cohn playbook, the spectacle, the circus aspect. Try it in the press. Never back down, use threats, and all of this is right out of Roy Cohn. And so I don't know how much he's listening to his current counsel, but he's still listening to the voice of Roy Cohn in his head.
Mark.
First of all, I need to go back and watch the season one recap, because some of these characters are from so long ago. I mean, Karen McDougal and Stormy Daniel or Stephanie Cliff. Well, I forgot. That was like season one. I mean, I don't remember a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
I
2015 you're going back to.
I come down in the middle on this. Look, I think it's good that we have a legal system that is so robust that if we do it right, we'll decide whether or not this man who is a former president is guilty of committing a crime or not. The crime's not that serious. As a nonviolent offender, he's not likely to spend time in jail. The thing that might change that is his behavior during the trial. I'd like to have an over-under on whether he gets fined or in prison for contempt of court. I think it probably stops at the fines during the trial. I don't think the political significance here is that great. I don't think there are that many people left in the middle or unaware of him. And I think we're in an age where the types of salacious conduct he's alleged to have been involved in isn't so serious that it sinks political campaigns, certainly not for somebody with his charisma. So, I may watch the season one recap, and then I'd like to just wait till this season is over and maybe watch the finale, but I'm not going to try and watch it episode by episode.
The shocking cliffhanger finale, right? I tell you what, I do worry for the potential jurors. Whoever does, at the end of the day, get seated, no matter what the decision is, there's going to be a large number of people who vehemently disagree. And there's a danger in that. And we need to stop. I'm a former criminal defense attorney, also worked as a prosecutor. I believe that there needs to be a respect for the judicial system, for the criminal justice system. I think we've lost a lot of that, and some of that due to the sort of the commentary around who's bringing what cases and the delving into their personal lives. I'm not saying that it's okay to hire your boyfriend to be a prosecutor as special counsel, but I do think, if you start chipping away at the credibility of the system, it falls apart very quickly. And it's really unfortunate. And, jurors should feel safe. They should feel the ability to, in a very unpressured way, make their determination on their own and then come up with a verdict. And I think that there's so many potential pressures here and opportunities for kind of inappropriate behavior that it's unnerving.
Well, not only the jurors should feel safe, but the judges should feel safe.
Yeah.
The judge's family should feel safe. I mean, there's a gag order now on Trump, and it extends to the judge's daughter because he was going after her. I mean, when the principal, Donald Trump, right, is out there attacking the judicial system, attacking the people who are, whose responsibility is to make sure that the law is meted out correctly and unbiased, in an unbiased manner, and he's just attacking people right and left, that also adds to the degradation and the disrespect for the judicial system. Not that I agree with every decision every jurist makes. I don't. But, that doesn't mean that they should become a target of violence, which is what this man is doing. He is fomenting more violence against people that he sees as his enemy, and these idiots who follow him are the ones who will carry that violence out. So he can say, I didn't do it. Not me. My hands are clean.
I mean, there has been a system in the past anyways where you could have anonymity of jurors, organized crime cases, that kind of thing. And I'm hoping that is something that's in place here. But I don't actually know. Yeah. I haven't followed it that closely.
Yeah, but I bet you they might be in place, but they'll find a way of leaking it. They'll find a way of getting it out. He'll pass a note to the National Enquirer. He'll do something.
He knows them? I think, weren't they
that was David Pecker.
Intimately involved?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. That's exactly it.
Anybody else have anything to say on this particular subject?
I mean, it's just, the potential violence against jurors, the chipping away at the legitimacy of our institutions. It's not just the judicial system. This is part of an overall trend, unfortunately, in the country. And we were talking before about people who are in the House of Representatives and political leaders in general. You know, they really have a role as leaders, all of them, to try to pull us back from the cliff, because if we continue toward that cliff, the ending is not good, not just in the judicial scene, but, after the elections in November. Our institutions, as you were saying, Heather, they're a lot more fragile than I think mm-hmm. we had ever thought.
Yep. All right, we'll hold there. I want to thank everybody for being with us and for your expertise and discussing these issues with us. Jim, you'll be back tomorrow. I look forward to that. We'll see you again. Mark, thank you very much for being here. Heather, always a pleasure. And Libby, we look forward to seeing you later on in the week. Thank you very much. We'll be back right after this.